Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In 1931, UC Berkeley scientist Ernest Lawrence invented the cyclotron, which transformed nuclear physics. And it also earned him a Nobel Prize and paved the way for the devastating bombs that helped win World War II. We'll talk with Los Angeles Times reporter Michael Hiltzik about his new book, Big Science, which outlines Lawrence's contributions to the Manhattan Project and the rise of the military-industrial complex. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And in this Forum hour, we welcome back Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and award-winning author Michael Hiltzik, who is a business columnist for the Los Angeles Times and has covered business, technology, and public policy for the LA Times for three decades. He's also the author of a couple books that we featured on Forum, Colossus, the turbulent, thrilling saga of the building of Hoover Dam, and The New Deal, Modern History, and is the author of Dealers of Lightning and the Plot Against Social Security. His most recent book is about a forgotten genius, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and inventor of the cyclotron, Ernest Lawrence, whose name is still attached to Lawrence Livermore. Michael Hiltzik's book is Big Science, Ernest Lawrence and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. And he joins us here in studio for the second hour. Welcome back.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and glad to talk about this forgotten genius, because he has had an exponential effect on, really changed the world. That's not even underestimating or using any kind of inflated rhetoric. And he ran like Archimedes yelling, "I'm going to be famous," when he discovered the cyclotron. Let's talk about that first, because that really lays a lot of the groundwork. A lot of people probably don't even know what a cyclotron is.
Right. Well, to put it briefly, a cyclotron was at the time the most effective, most efficient atom smasher that anyone had invented. And it came along at exactly the point that physics needed something like that, needed a way to apply new energies to projectiles to delve into the inner recesses of the atomic nucleus. And Ernest Lawrence, a lot of the ideas behind the cyclotron were in the wind, but he was the one who put them together and actually created the machine that did revolutionize physics and science overall.
And allowed us to discover all these subatomic particles and really change particles into, well, bullets, really.
well, that's right. And to this day, I mean, the Large Hadron Collider, which is buried under the landscape on the French-Swiss border, is at its core a cyclotron. It's the latest generation of the machine that Ernest Lawrence invented.
To discover the Higgs boson.
It discovered the Higgs in 2012, and it's discovering more subatomic particles all the time. Every discovery opens the vistas for new discoveries. And that was something that Lawrence really understood.
But this guy also gave us radar. He gave us the A-bomb. He worked on the H-bomb. I mean, you know, this is an amazing trail. Some of it, of course, troubling because we're in the thermonuclear age. But the reality is that his contributions were extraordinary. And his life was fascinating. And you get into the whole biography here as well. And I want to do that. But let's get a little local first, because UC Berkeley plays a pretty preeminent role. I don't know that there would have been a cyclotron without UC Berkeley.
Well, there wouldn't have been a cyclotron without Berkeley, and of course there wouldn't have been one without Lawrence. And I think the interesting local side of this is that at the time that Lawrence was recruited to join the Berkeley faculty, it really was a backwater of physics. It played a very prominent role in chemistry, but it was struggling with physics. It had a lot of money, a lot of patrons, and terrific facilities, but it had not been able to recruit the leading physicists that it was looking for to run the department. So the University of California trustees and administrators looked for a different approach. They decided to go for young researchers whose best years were ahead of them. And at the top of that list at the time was this young man, Ernest Lawrence, who was at that time a junior professor at Yale. And they persuaded him that if he came west to Berkeley, he would get everything he wanted and advance rapidly. And he took the bait and almost single-handedly changed Berkeley into the leading research university that it is.
Almost reminds me in some ways of another UC, UC San Francisco, which we had Henry Bourne on, you know, who has written the history of it. And a lot of people who were brought here were people who were given a lot of free rein to experiment. Yale would have been pretty stodgy and inflexible in many ways.
Well, and that was the pitch that the University of California, Raymond Burge, who was at that time the chairman of the physics department, that was the pitch he gave to Lawrence. He said, look, you know, it's going to be years before you can become an associate professor or an assistant professor, much less a full professor there. Here, you are going to be the top man. He was absolutely right. And it was an inspired choice, and it worked out best for everybody.
Talking to Michael Hiltzik, and his new book is called Big Science. And to some extent, you see Lawrence as sort of the pappy of big science. Let's talk about big science. Comes to us from someone named Alvin Weinberg, coined it in 1961, a long number of years after the cyclotron, to be sure.
Well, that's right. And by the time that Weinberg, who actually had worked with Lawrence when Lawrence was alive, by the time he coined the phrase, the paradigm had been in place for many decades. And it really did begin with Lawrence and his cyclotron. Because every discovery that the cyclotron made really, as I said, opened the vistas to new needs. So Lawrence continued to refine it. He built new cyclotrons, each one bigger, more powerful, and much more expensive than the last. It became clear that any university that wanted to hold up its end as a major research university needed a cyclotron of its own. So these were multi-million dollar machines. Very quickly, they outstripped the ability of the universities to fund them. So their promoters had to go to foundations, to government, and to industry. And you really did have this new paradigm of capital-intensive, big-team, multidisciplinary research that really did have its roots in the cyclotron.
And he was also really a team guy. I mean, he had a lot to do with spearheading this whole idea of a kind of collective effort to bring some of these things to fruition. We should also mention that along with everything else, probably a good deal of nuclear medicine and artificial isotopes, things like that, come from the work that Lawrence did. It's just extraordinary, the impact that he had. And the reality is, I suppose, to some degree, that it's continuing. I mean, we have to talk about big science continuing. It's a lot of the money's dried up, the government support, I think, use the example of the Genome Project, which had to move into public hands because it couldn't be sustained through the military-industrial complex, which is also what we're really talking about here. I mean, Eisenhower warned us against this, but this is the beginning of the launch of the military-industrial complex.
That's right. Bringing in industry as a major patron, bringing in government as a major patron, that did create basically a whole new complex of funders of basic science and then of applied science. And, of course, it was World War II that really validated that paradigm, and Lawrence played a key role in the Manhattan Project that, as I said, really showed what big science could achieve when you brought together a huge team of multidisciplinary researchers and gave them billions of dollars and a shared goal.
Would not have had and some would think maybe this is a good thing, Nagasaki or Hiroshima, had it not been for Ernest Lawrence.
Well, that's right. And that, of course, it's fair to say that's his most morally equivocal legacy. But he really, at a point when the government was on the verge of canceling the atomic bomb program because it wasn't convinced that an atomic bomb could be developed in time to affect the war. This was 1941, so it was the coming war. And if this big project wouldn't make a difference in the war, then it was not going to get funded. It was Lawrence who personally interceded, made it clear that a bomb was feasible and, as he put it, urgent and necessary because of fears that Nazi Germany was working on it. And he turned that around on his authority, essentially, and with his stature behind it, he saved the Manhattan Project.
And, of course, after that, after the bomb ended the war in many people's minds, it became pretty obvious that big science was sort of ruling the roost here in the United States and in Western countries. We keep building bigger machines and we keep doing more for humanity or more weaponry that will reduce humanity, whichever the case.
Well, that's right. Big science, science in general and big science specifically, it's hard to say that it's good or bad in itself. It really is what we do with it. And I think one of the consequences of the war, of the atomic bomb program and the hydrogen bomb program afterwards, is that scientists recognize that they don't have the control over their discoveries that they did in the era of small science, that they have to play a political and social role in trying to make sure that what they discover is put to beneficial use.
We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Michael Heltzik, author of Big Science, Ernest Lawrence, and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. And he'll be speaking at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 6 o'clock. We really can't talk about Ernest Lawrence and the Manhattan Project and all that he represents without talking about his relationship with Oppenheimer. And in some ways, I mean, I noticed you got a nice plug here from Richard Rhodes on the back of your book, but Richard Rhodes probably saw Oppenheimer a lot more important than you see him. I mean, you see Lawrence as having a great deal of the lion's share in terms of what we're talking about here with the Manhattan Project and A-bomb.
Yes. Well, I think it's clear when you look at the record that Lawrence had, in many ways, a much more expansive role in the Manhattan Project, first of all, than he's given credit for today. And I think that the biographers of Robert Oppenheimer give him credit for, although there's been some great work. Obviously, Oppenheimer was a key figure, but one thing that I think people don't recognize is that it was Ernest Lawrence who got him the job and put him in place in the lab that became Los Alamos.
And saved things once they were ready to kind of scrap the whole Manhattan Project, didn't he? And
yes,
he went to FDR?
That's right. Well, he went to James Conin,
right,
who was FDR's one of FDR's scientific advisors, and yes, and he made sure that the Manhattan Project would continue. And then after the war, it was Lawrence who, with Edward Teller, actively promoted the hydrogen bomb, which was a much more equivocal weapon and one that many of their colleagues in the Manhattan Project.
Morally equivocal. Yeah.
Morally equivocal and in many ways militarily equivocal. Something that scientists who had been four square behind the Manhattan Project during the war were really against and very doubtful about and opposed. And they saw the hydrogen bomb as a weapon of genocide, not an effective military weapon. And that led to something of a split between Lawrence and the rest of the scientific community that he had worked with so closely.
Yeah, and let's talk about that, particularly about the relationship of Lawrence and Robert Oppenheimer, because they were really like two peas in a pod. They were very close, supporting each other, helping each other. One was more theoretical, the other was more experimental. But the reality is that things went awry, and it got to the point where Lawrence was ready to testify against Oppenheimer.
That's right. Well, he came very close to that point. To start at the beginning, they really came to Berkeley at almost the same time, I think about a year apart. And in the early years, they were very, very close friends and complementary friends, a symbiotic relationship that they had. Oppenheimer was a master theorist, but pretty hopeless when it came to machinery. Lawrence didn't always have the best grasp of theory, but he was a master experimentalist, and they worked very closely together. Lawrence would come up with some result from the cyclotron, and then he would march it over to Oppenheimer, and Oppenheimer would explain what was going on under the hood of the physics. Lawrence's first child, Robert, was named after Oppenheimer. It shows you how close they were. But they were fundamentally different personalities. Lawrence had grown up in the Midwest.
South Dakota, wasn't he?
South Dakota, a rural community. He was born to a Norwegian-American immigrant family. pretty straight-laced, was married to the same woman all his adult life. Oppenheimer was freewheeling. He was a leftist. He had grown up in the ethical culture society milieu of Manhattan. He had been trained in Europe. This was training that Lawrence didn't have. He was a womanizer. I think when he came to Berkeley, he was between his first and second marriages. And eventually their personalities began to grate. But what really drove them apart was this conflict over whether to build the super, whether to build the hydrogen bomb. Oppenheimer, coming out of the war with tremendous fame that rivaled Lawrence's, was against it. He was militating against it. Lawrence believed it was necessary for national security and began to doubt Oppenheimer's loyalty. And when the AEC started its investigation, Louis Strauss, the head of the AEC, who was a major enemy of Oppenheimer's and a friend of Lawrence's, persuaded Lawrence to testify at Oppenheimer's security hearing. And just 2 days before that was to happen, Lawrence basically backed out because he began to see that there was a minority of in the scientific community that opposed Oppenheimer, and it was all centered at Berkeley, at Lawrence's lab, and he recognized that this sort of testimony would just not be good for the lab and not be good for himself. And
he claimed he had colitis, though, or is it?
Well, he did have colitis, and in fact, there's a rather grisly moment when he tried to prove to some of his colleagues. He was at Oak Ridge sort of at a conference and, you know, proved to some of his colleagues that he really was sick, but he called Louis Strauss, said, "I'm too sick to testify." Strauss berated him viciously, called him yellow and a coward, but couldn't persuade him to change his mind. And Lawrence flew back to Berkeley and left it to Luis Alvarez, another Nobel physicist who worked with him at Berkeley, to testify against Oppenheimer at the hearing. And he really did sort of fire bullets at Oppenheimer at that hearing.
Well, you mentioned, you describe, I think, aptly and correctly, Oppenheimer as a leftist. It's also probably fair to say, even though he seemed apolitical up to a degree, that Ernest Lawrence became a Cold Warrior.
He did become a Cold Warrior, and I think that's an artifact of the relationships that he began to build with wealthy patrons, not only here on the West Coast, but on the East Coast. He got very close to Jack Nalin, who was a trustee of the University of California, very right-wing businessman lawyer here in Northern California. And I think Lawrence began to take on their coloration. Nalin was a ferocious Cold Warrior, a ferocious anti-communist. And Lawrence basically went along with that. He didn't speak out about communism. He didn't militate against it, but he was silent during the great Berkeley loyalty oath controversy when Nalin and other trustees of the University of California tried to get the faculty to sign loyalty oaths that they were not now and never had been members of the Communist Party. A lot of the faculty at Berkeley looked to Lawrence to speak out against this loyalty oath, and he remained silent.
Well, he liked money. I mean, that comes across.
Well, he liked money. He needed money for his research. I don't think anyone could say that he got rich personally, but he did have a way of accessing a lot of wealth, and he thought it was important. And as I said, he began to reflect the views of his wealthiest patrons.
It's also kind of talking about his genius in so many respects, a promotional and salesman genius too in many respects, yeah?
Well, he was, and that was one of the secrets of his role in building big science. He had a way of understanding what his patrons' goals were and how he could adjust his own work to serve those goals without really compromising what he was doing. There was a period, for example, when it became clear that foundation money was going to be scarce for physics research, which, of course, was what he was doing. But he discovered that money was abundant for medical research. And lo and behold, the cyclotron became an instrument for medical research. He did a lot to use the cyclotron to develop medical isotopes, radio sodium, radiophosphorus, and even built a new cyclotron that was sort of tuned to that that sort of research. Now, this was research that, in one way or another, he might have done anyway. But he did understand that this was a way of promoting what he was doing and tapping into the available money. And he was very adept at that and very agile at that. And that's part of how he secured the patronage of the U.S. government for a lot of his work.
Our guest is Michael Heltzik. He's here in studio with us. He's been with the Los Angeles Times for decades. Is now their business columnist, also a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, and author of Big Science, Ernest Lawrence, and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. And we're really talking about two great technological achievements that have in many ways been tied to Ernest Lawrence. Obviously, the atomic bomb and radar, which together may have indeed won the Second World War. Michael Heltzik will be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club at 6 o'clock, and you can speak with him. In fact, let me invite your participation in this program, talking about Lawrence, but also talking about Big Science, and maybe get some thoughts from you about where Big Science has been, where it's gone. Our toll-free number is available right now to you. It's 866-733-6786. So feel free to join the program. Again, you can do that toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. Or post questions or comments you have, or join the conversation online, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You know, you've been kind of found this niche for yourself in the 30s and 40s. What draws you?
Well, it's sort of an evolution. I was first drawn to Hoover Dam, as you mentioned, which, of course, was one of the great monuments of the 30s. That led to my book on the New Deal, which sort of as a follow-on. And when you read about science in that era and the history of science, you inevitably come face-to-face with the legacy of Ernest Lawrence. And when I was looking for a book project, I got curious about him. And as with all my book projects, I just couldn't find enough to satisfy my curiosity that was already public. So I decided to do the research myself.
Your curiosity is quite extensive, if I may say so. And I'm just curious about something else myself. That is, we just did a program on the SETI money, which has come through. A lot of private money is in the mix now, but certainly venture capitalists don't like to necessarily venture into things unless they feel there's going to be some profit. What's Big Science today? Is it? I mean, I guess we think about battling diseases or climate change, new energy, new ways to produce food. I mean, it's still there, really, isn't it?
Well, it is. It always gets bigger. The Large Hadron Collider that we've talked about, that cost $9 billion to build. And some of its discoveries point to the need for an even bigger collider, which will cost even more money. I think there's a lot of concern in the scientific community that we may be getting to the point, the political and economic limits a big science, because there's so much demand, especially on government funding. A lot of this has shifted to industry, which doesn't take the same approach to science.
We welcome your participation. Again, feel free to join us. We're talking about how UC Berkeley nuclear physicist Ernest Lawrence helped launch the era of big science with Michael Heltzik, who's here in studio with us, the author of Big Science, Ernest Lawrence, and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, but feel free to join the conversation. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 1931, UC Berkeley scientist Ernest Lawrence invented the cyclotron, which transformed nuclear physics and earned him a Nobel Prize and paved the way for the devastating bombs that helped win World War II. We're talking with LA Times reporter Michael Heltzik about his new book, Big Science, which outlines Lawrence's contributions to the Manhattan Project and the rise of the military-industrial complex. And I've got to get us on record here about something, Michael, and that is been talking about morally equivocal things. I mean, in many people's minds, once we had the bomb, the genie was out of the bottle. Once, we could get into all the arguments that have gone on perennially since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I guess in the research you did, you began to understand some of the nuances of this to a greater degree. That is, we were in a real race. That is, the United States was in a real race, fearing that the Nazis were going to get it.
That's right, and that is really what drove a lot of the willingness of physicists, allied physicists, and many of those who had come across as refugees from Germany and Austria. There was a concern that was expressed in the famous letter that Albert Einstein signed to FDR in 1939. He warned that, first of all, that a bomb was conceivable and that Nazi Germany might already be working on it. So there was this real concern that the Nazis were working on a bomb, and if they got there first, civilization would hang in the balance. And I think that's what makes the work of these physicists on the Manhattan Project defensible. And I think it's clear when you read their memoirs and what they said at the time that few of them had real qualms while they were working on the bomb because of that, though they began to have qualms about what was going to happen in the post-war period, even late in the war, and started talking about the social and political implications of this weapon and how we might corral it. Oppenheimer was a very important advocate for international control of nuclear energy, but wasn't very good at articulating how that would work. And I think that was the problem that diplomats and policymakers in Washington always had was, well, if America and the United Kingdom abjured research on atomic weapons, how would that persuade the Soviets from not doing it anyway? And I think that's sort of the problem that we still have in terms of, how do we bring this destructive power under safe control?
Facing it with Iran.
Exactly.
But not only with Iran, unfortunately, with the ongoing arms race, which a lot of the fear of Iran getting a nuclear weapon was the fear that also Saudi Arabia and Egypt would want to have a nuclear weapon and so forth. I keep thinking about, Oppenheimer and the Bhagavad Gita, and, I've now unleashed all this chaotic, catastrophic, potentially force upon the world, upon the planet. But didn't Lawrence oppose a nuclear test ban? That was back in the 1956 presidential election.
Well, yes, that's true. Lawrence really he did not believe that that a test ban could be enforced. He did a study. It was a study that was not widely accepted by policymakers, but it was a study nonetheless in which he speculated that to really keep an eye on the Soviet Union, you would need 30,000 inspectors. It seemed like a very large number, and it was certainly not one that American diplomats thought the Soviets would accept. So it was really his doubts that any sort of test ban could be enforced that drove his opposition. He participated in disarmament conferences toward the end of his life, but not for very long. And I think he was searching for a way to bring this under control, but never found one to his satisfaction. And as we've said, this was a real cause of the split between him and Oppenheimer late in their lives.
Didn't his wife also want the name Lawrence taken off of Lawrence Livermore Lab because they were doing research in nuclear weapons and essentially building them?
That's right. Molly Lawrence, by then his widow in the 1980s, was appalled at nuclear proliferation in general and at the role of Lawrence Livermore Lab in it. And the Livermore Lab, after all, had been founded as the nation's hydrogen bomb laboratory by Ernest Lawrence. There was no secret about what it was all about. It was there to assist Los Alamos.
They could have called it the Teller
lab. Well, yeah, but it was Lawrence's lab. Okay. I mean, he brought
it was Teller
from
that
in.
Rad lab that started earlier.
Well, it was an offshoot of the radiation lab was the Berkeley lab, and it's still there as the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Livermore was a second lab that Lawrence had founded. First for a machine that he conceived that didn't work. But very soon he remade it as a lab specifically to work on hydrogen bomb technology. Now, Molly Lawrence began to feel, as proliferation became an issue, that her husband would not really have been comfortable with the level of proliferation, the way, as we've said, the genie got out of the bottle, and at the Livermore Lab's role in it. And she petitioned first the UC trustees and then Congress to take his name off that lab. Now, one of the problems she ran into was that Ernest's brother, John Lawrence, who was a UC trustee, was very conservative and didn't believe that Ernest would have been aghast at this. He thought this is the world that Ernest thought would come to pass, and that Livermore was doing important work for peace and for national security. So he opposed it, and in any event, there was no chance. Congress turned her down. And, of course, to this day, it's known as Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory.
And we'll bring our callers in, and we begin, Scott, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I've got this impression of big science that it's largely constrained or distorted by the profit model. And I have nothing against profit. I make my living on profit. But my impression is that generations from now, they'll look back on us and say, well, they did certainly some fascinating things with science, but the poor people, they hamstrung themselves on the profit model and got into these deep channels of thought and research to the neglect or detriment of other avenues. And I was just wondering, in your research, do you have that impression as well, or is my impression wrong? As I talk with people at Stanford or wherever it is, MIT or Harvard, am I completely off base?
No.
I'll take my answer.
No, your impression really is not wrong. It's right in many ways. But I think we have to look at big science as something that's evolved. It, of course, by its nature, it requires a lot of capital. It requires a lot of money, and money has its own weight, its own influence. What we have seen, particularly in recent decades, is that the weight of funding of big science has shifted somewhat from government, which our government leaders talk about the constraints on the government budget and on the size of government, and it has moved toward industry a lot more. Well, government is more inclined to fund basic research, research that will go wherever it goes without much consideration for its commercial potential. When the weight shifts to industry, industry is more inclined to fund applied research, developmental research that will improve its own bottom line and that will serve its core needs. And I think we have seen this evolution toward research that does have a commercial focus. And at the same time, the need to bring in so much money has led, just by its very nature, to the commercialization of academic research, more patenting, more secrecy, more inclination by professors to start companies that can exploit their own discoveries. And I think that's a trend that many people rightly find disquieting.
And Scott, I thank you for your call. Let me get right to another caller, and that's Dave. Good morning. You're on forum.
Good morning. Great topic. I wanted to ask whether there was any kind of relationship between Edward Teller, and positive or negative, and Lawrence.
Yes. Well, they had a very close relationship, though not necessarily an entirely positive one. As I point out in my book, it's proper to look at Livermore, the foundation of Livermore, as the hydrogen bomb lab, in a way as the answer to the question of what do we do with Edward Teller? Teller was a crucial figure in the development of the hydrogen bomb because he was the physicist who understood how to do it. He was associated with Los Alamos, but it got to the point where no one at Los Alamos wanted to work with him. He was an obstreperous
person. A very difficult man, from all accounts.
An extremely difficult man to work with. He was very self-centered. He wanted to be the boss of all the research that he was associated with. Los Alamos just couldn't work with him. And the Atomic Energy Commission, which was in charge in the post-war years of this sort of research, really didn't know what to do. But here's Ernest Lawrence. He had a lab that he had founded at Livermore that basically built a machine that was a white elephant and it needed a new role. He offered it as a second lab to complement Los Alamos, and he offered to take on Teller. The Atomic Energy Commission figured, well, you know, Teller's a guy who, if you thwart him as a scientist, he decides that you're not a very good scientist. But it was unlikely he could do that with Ernest Lawrence, whose stature was just too great at the time. So they decided to work together, but as it turned out, the approaches of Lawrence and Teller toward management, scientific management, were really at odds. Lawrence liked a flat organization where almost everybody was on an equal footing. He didn't like giving people titles. Teller was a guy who wanted to be the boss and wanted everybody subservient to him. So they had a very difficult relationship. In fact, Herb York, who was the nominal head of the Livermore lab, ended up being their go-between because Lawrence and Teller couldn't communicate with one another. They had to do it by proxy. So, but eventually Teller got a role, an important role as a research figure at Livermore, and did play a role in developing the hydrogen bombs that that were tested through the 50s and into the 60s.
And Dave, we thank you for your call. Let me go to some emails here. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. Doug writes, I can't remember how she knew him, but Julia Dunham, my chemistry biology teacher in high school in the 60s, knew Lawrence and used to regale us with all sorts of stories about him to encourage us. Comment from a listener named Virginia. My dad worked on cyclotron, Guido Rossi. He died early at 46 in 1956. I have a science notebook. I'd like to share it with your guest.
I'd love to see it.
And here's another list. You just sent it to the Los Angeles Times, Michael Helsick. Yeah?
Sure.
My grandfather, John Ramon Ramirez, worked on the Manhattan Project in New York City. According to my grandmother, he did not know what it was exactly he was working on. She said that many groups of scientists were working on various parts of the project in various U.S. locations, completely unaware that the individual pieces, when put together, would produce the A-bomb. My grandmother said that he was devastated and felt extremely betrayed when he realized the result of his labor.
Well, I think that's quite true. The principle at work was known as compartmentalization. This was a creation of General Leslie Groves, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, and it was the principle basically was you were told enough to do the work that you were assigned, but there were very few scientists who really had a handle on the whole picture. Lawrence, of course, was one of them. Oppenheimer was one of them. There were, I don't know, half a dozen or a dozen who knew what the goal was. Certainly the scientists at Los Alamos who were working on the design, especially of the plutonium bomb that ended up devastating Nagasaki, they knew what they were working on. But certainly most of the scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project didn't know exactly what they were working on, and they certainly didn't know at what stage the project was until the word came over and they all learned it in real time that the bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima and then 3 days later on Nagasaki.
But as you say, Lawrence was certainly privy from the beginning right up to the end, and didn't he kind of provide most of the weapon-grade uranium?
Well, that's right. Lawrence converted his biggest cyclotron to a machine that would refine uranium. That is, it would separate the fissionable isotope U-235. This was the key to creating the bomb core for the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. And then he supervised the construction of the vast factory that did the refining at Oak Ridge. And that factory, using Lawrence's method and a couple of others that fed into it, did produce every atom of the uranium core that went into Hiroshima. And, of course, the discovery of plutonium took place at Lawrence's lab at Berkeley using his cyclotron. It was done by Glenn Seaborg and Ed McMillan. That process implemented at Hanford in Washington State produced all the plutonium that went into the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki.
We're talking again with Michael Hiltzik, and his book is called Big Science, Ernest Lawrence and the Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. Go to another caller. Hank, that's you. Join us.
Yeah, hi. I wondered if Lawrence was one of the promoters of Atoms for Peace and nuclear power after World War II and into the 50s. And if he wasn't, could you tell us which of the labs or physicists pushed that program?
Sure. Well, he did participate in that program. Atoms for Peace was the brainchild of Louis Strauss, who was the head of the AEC and was looking for a way. It was, in many ways, a public relations effort to take the taint of destruction and death out of nuclear power. But it really was a handmaiden toward what Strauss thought was really important, which was nuclear weaponry. But there were a lot of elements to Atoms for Peace. There were a lot of – certainly the development of nuclear power, public nuclear power, development of many other technologies. And Lawrence participated in almost all of those, in part because the government was willing to fund them and the work could be done at his lab at Berkeley and at Livermore. So he was an enthusiastic participant in Atoms for Peace, among so many other things.
And we thank Hank for the call. Let me go to an email here from David, who writes, please ask the author what his book adds to the portrait of Lawrence in Newell Fan Davis's entertaining and insightful Lawrence and Oppenheimer from 1964. And then he adds, I couldn't disagree more with the author about the rise of big science. Here's what mattered more in big science, big applied science. Radar development mattered a lot more. The U.S. Army, led by General Groves, developed the atomic bomb with almost two dozen facilities, many of extraordinary novelty, scope, and ambition, such as at Oak Ridge. Los Alamos had the interesting people and publicity, but enrichment was the hard problem, and the U.S. Army organized it. The military did the first practical antibiotics. They scaled up vaccine production in crazy, ambitious ways, too, as men were put under arms.
Well, a couple of questions there. First of all, the book Lawrence and Oppenheimer by Newell Farr Davis, it is very entertaining, but it's also got a lot of questionable elements to it. I think historians who've looked at it, and I looked at it too, find a lot in there that isn't supported. It's a lot of it is fanciful. It's not widely accepted as an authoritative source. But I did consult it, and to the extent that I could verify what was in it, I mined it and cited it. I'm not sure that the caller and I necessarily disagree on big science. I've made clear in my book that it's brought us a lot that's good for humanity. It's all around us. The Human Genome Project is big science. Nuclear medicine is big science. NASA is big science. Certainly, there is a lot. I would point out, however, that the enrichment program that the military undertook at Oak Ridge was a creation of Ernest Lawrence. He invented the process.
Big question, but how sustainable is big science?
Well, that's a question that I think really has been raised since Alvin Weinberg, who we talked about earlier, coined the phrase. He coined the term in the course of an essay questioning the future of big science, and as we said, this was in the early 1960s. Because it costs so much money, you know, when you have government programs, government funding that takes so much resources, inevitably you are going to find yourself in conflict with other needs, other public needs, whether it's ending hunger and or poverty or bringing vaccines and medicines to larger populations. And this has been a debate that's been going on for decades. I think, you know, in this country, big science has been under threat. In 1993, Congress canceled a huge big science project. That was the superconducting super collider.
It's funny you should mention it. I'm looking at an online comment. Let me just bring this in and get your response to it. The shutdown of superconductor super collider in Texas by the Republican Party was a great betrayal to Lawrence and the American people. It also led to the loss of thousands of scientific jobs, as well as the loss of science research in the U.S. and exporting all advance that started by Lawrence and UC Berkeley and sent it abroad. Shameful.
Well, I think that's certainly a fair way to look at it, but I think we have to look at it with some nuance. What happened with the superconducting supercollider, a couple of things. First of all, certainly the scale of the project was enormous. $2 billion had already been spent on it when it was canceled by Congress. This came up at a point when we had a new class of Congress, mostly Republicans coming in, who had run on the theme of smaller government and government cutbacks. The superconducting supercollider was an obvious target. But on the other side, something that I think is very instructive for us going forward is that the scientific community did not really adequately support that project. There was even a split within the physics community about the superconducting supercollider because it served one school of physics and not other schools of physics. So scientists weren't speaking with one voice. Certainly at the time, it was hard to find a figure like Lawrence, who was a unifying figure, one with authority. And I think that's what is really the need going ahead, is that scientists and advocates for science have to find a way to make the case for these projects as they become more and more expensive, because the goals of basic science sometimes seem very, very remote to the needs of the immediate needs of members of the public. So you really need an educational process. I don't think we've had one that's been very good in recent years. And of course, the great generation of scientists that Lawrence represented has passed. I mean, in his years, you had Lawrence, you had Oppenheimer, you had people like Linus Pauling, you had Vannevar Bush, who was a great advocate for science education. They were all around in the 1950s and the 1960s, when I think a lot of us look back on as the golden years of scientific education and the promotion of science in the United States. It's hard to look around and find anybody like that today, and I think we are going to need to find them if we really are going to support big science and push it ahead in a way that that serves humanity and really is humanity's thirst for knowledge that's driving this.
The irony to me, though, in some respects, is those golden years for scientists that you just alluded to with that call it a clique of great scientists, a cohort, that's the word that people like to use these days, of great scientists. Probably the one that's less known is Lawrence, I mean, of the ones you named. And yet he was the top scientist in his day. He was a celebrity scientist. He was a Nobel Prize winner. He was probably really top of the heap.
That's right. I think I make the point that during his life, he was the most famous American-born scientist in America, cover of Time magazine, first winner of the Nobel Prize from a public university in the U.S., very authoritative, very popular, very skilled at making concepts clear to laypersons. But I think he has been overshadowed since his death, in part because he died young at 58, by others, by Linus Pauling, certainly by Oppenheimer, who was in the public sphere for much longer.
Here's a listener who writes, it saddens me that most people only think about bombs and power plants when they think about nuclear physics. Lay media isn't doing enough to shine spotlight on other aspects of nuclear physics research, such as making the periodic table three-dimensional by switching quark types, among other things. It's a reflection of the state of science media and an apathetic public, where only major news like new pictures of Pluto get attention, but the discovery of the pentaquark got barely any coverage.
Well, that's fair. Of course, the pictures from Pluto, I think, have been
pretty amazing, really.
Well, they've been amazing, and they've been positive in terms of showing what science can do. And of course, the Pluto mission is a big science project. It's cost $700 million. And it not only has, I think, thrilled scientists and laypersons alike, it's already taught us a lot about the birth and life cycle of planets that we didn't know. Scientists say they're surprised. We can look at these pictures and be amazed. And I think, you know, you do have to sometimes rely on high-profile events like the Pluto voyage to push science along. I wouldn't dispute that the media could do a lot more to promote these ideas and principles. But I think scientists have to do a lot more, and we learn every day how to do it better. And sometimes we put what we learn into practice, and sometimes we don't, but we all try.
As a listener named Liz, who writes, the forum audience might also find it interesting that Lawrence and his family endowed the University of California with a public service center in 1968 that was built in his namesake. For 50-plus years, standing above the university and overlooking the San Francisco Bay, the Lawrence Hall of Science is a local institution committed to inspiring and fostering learning of science and mathematics for all, especially those who have limited access to science.
That's absolutely true, and it's a great resource, and I would encourage all the listeners to go visit there and learn what it has to teach, which is a lot.
What do you have to teach us? What, above all, do you want the public to know about Ernest Lawrence that's lasting and enduring and his legacy and his contributions?
Well, I think it's the most important thing is that Lawrence really did represent, I think, a great idea in science, which is that you could use it to do great things. There is so much that we can learn about the natural world that we live in, and we need to do everything we can to do that. I think Lawrence himself understood the limitations of the paradigm of science he had created, although he didn't have to live with them very much. But he did create a new paradigm. It's a paradigm that drives scientific research to this day. Amazing that he could invent it essentially in 1931 and that it's still relevant in the 21st century. And it really is a testament to humankind's unquenchable thirst for knowledge about the natural world. He was a great exemplar of that quest and somebody I think we should admire for all his flaws and as we said, all the equivocal legacy. It still is a great legacy.
Well, let us leave it there. Michael Helsig, always good to have you. Thank you so much for being with us. His book, again, is Big Science, Ernest Lawrence, an Invention That Launched the Military-Industrial Complex. You can meet him this evening at the Commonwealth Club. He'll be there at 6 p.m. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Vinnie Tong. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Latoya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.